Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We once had a listener who objected to any conversation on this program that wasn't exclusively tied to Vermont. So if we talked about the conditions in refugee camps where some Syrians were living prior to coming to Vermont, he'd write, "What is this, Syria edition?" But we know, as all of you do, that we are all interconnected these days, and it's impossible to separate Vermont from the wider world. Why would we want to? A few years ago, we did a series of interviews we called Vermonters Without Borders, where we interviewed interesting people in our region who had spent time doing fascinating and meaningful things in other parts of the world. The idea was to highlight Vermonters with interesting stories, but also to hear a little bit about parts of the world we might not otherwise talk about on this show. Today, we are revisiting that idea with a whole show about Vermonters Without Borders. We'll start today with Stan Duda. Stan lives in Shrewsbury and is a Habitat for Humanity Global Village Program team leader. Stan, nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
What does your title actually mean, Habitat for Humanity Global Village Program team leader?
Well, Global Village has a program where they take volunteers to various countries to do building houses, and I am the team leader who gets people to join the team and get them all set up to go, and then we go as a group, and then I manage them as when we get in country.
And you just got back from Malawi. Can you talk a little bit about what you did?
Yes, I took 15 people to Malawi, and we were there for about 10 days, and I got home last Thursday. And typically on a Global Village trip, teams arrive on a Saturday. Team members arrive on Saturday, and they come from all parts of the United States and some from other countries. On this particular trip, I had a lady from Trinidad, Tobago, and a woman from India. I also had three minors on our team, so our age range went from 17 years old to 70. So they all arrived in Malawi on a Saturday, and then on Sunday we had an orientation, and then stayed overnight. And then on Sunday we went down to the village area and checked into the hotel where we were going to be working for the week. And we actually built two homes in two villages in Salima, Malawi, which is about an hour and a half from Lilongwe. And we split the team in half, and by the end of the week we got both houses upped. All the walls up to the roof level, and they had hired people to put the roof on. And so when we left on Saturday, we had our final closing ceremony and celebration. They're ready to put the roof on the house.
You know, you actually worked in the construction business. You're retired now, I understand. But so you have some skills in building homes. Has that helped you in doing this work?
Well, yes and no, because the Global Village program, it's interesting. When I get applications like this particular build, I took 15 people, but I had almost 80 to 90 applications. And when I set up a phone call with these folks to go over possibly joining the team, the first thing they tell me is they don't have any construction experience. And I find that that's an asset as opposed to being a negative, because in the countries that I've been to, there aren't any tools. Everything is very basic and very primitive. So you don't need any experience in construction. You just sort of have to have a willingness to work in a group, like to have fun, sort of like to think outside your comfort zone, and like to work in a group, and it's all physical hard work. Now, I do have lots of construction experience, but I don't really use it on the build, because Habitat has a local affiliate that hires local craft workers to show us how to do the work. And so I sort of preached with my team, you let them tell us what to do. We are guests in their country, and so we shouldn't be telling them what to do. And the only time that I interject in anything is if I see something that's an unsafe condition for my team members, then I will get together with the people, the foreman or the supervisor from that country, and go over on how we can fix that so my team can adequately work safely. So even though my experience is vast, but I don't normally offer it, because I just feel that I just tell my team, we don't want to come across as know-it-all ugly Americans or wherever we're from. We're there to work with them, and we're guests, and we'll follow their lead.
Although I guess it's nice that nobody has to teach you how to swing a hammer. But, you know, Stan, you bring up a point about saying, you know, we're guests in another person's country, and they tell us what they need. And I think, you know, a lot of the questions about international aid work, and particularly times when people might join a group like this to go somewhere for a week and sort of drop in, there are these questions and concerns about poverty tourism or people going to a place and not really doing what people in that area really need. So how do you think about that, and how do you address that with your teams when you go on builds?
Well, Global Village is pretty strict on what we do there and how we're supposed to behave while we're in country. Every single country I go to, there's a Habitat affiliate there, and they look at the needs of the various areas in their country as far as housing that is needed. In Malawi, for instance, most of the people, family unit earns less than $2 a day, so there's a gigantic need for housing, and four out of five people that live in Malawi live in substandard housing. So the homes that we built are very similar to a home that is in Malawi that is strong enough and safe enough for people to live in. So they pick the partner families that we're going to be working for with. They pick the village that we're going to work in, and you know, we go there as volunteers just to work. We don't go there with all sorts of gifts to give them to raise their standards or make them, you know, set apart from the rest of the people that are in the village. So gift giving, as far as many of my team members want to do more than just build, but I tell them, you know, this is the greatest asset or gift you can give anybody is a new home. And the average home in Malawi that's a Habitat home costs about $5,500. And I would say after we leave, after another couple weeks, the locals will finish it, and these families will have a home that they never expected to get. And they're so grateful by that. But then again, many of my team members will bring gifts. They'll bring medical equipment. They'll bring school supplies. Lots of the team members, I tell them, when you go on a build, go through your wardrobe and pick out clothing that you're probably not going to wear anymore and bring that to the build and wear it, and we will leave it there for the people of Malawi to have. But all of these gifts that we're giving, we will give them to Habitat Malawi, and they will then take those gifts and get them to the proper agencies for people that need them. It's not like we're handing this out to the people of the village. Otherwise, it'll make it, as you said, it'll make it more like tourism, and you will have people living in a village that will feel special as opposed to the other people that are living there. So it's closely controlled by the Habitat and Global Village program.
So, Stan, I understand that it was your wife, Louise, who actually got you into this, and now you've done something like 26 or 27 builds. And I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about what you get out of doing this work.
Well, it's really interesting because my wife went on a build to Florida, and she wanted me to go back in 2004, and I sort of didn't believe in the program. You know, being in construction, I said to her, why would I want to go, a guy that knows a lot about construction, hook up with all these people that I don't know and who have no construction experience? And it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem. But anyway, she went and she came back and she says, it's not like that. And she convinced me to go ahead and do something the following year. So she and I went to El Salvador. And it was really different, really different. And yes, we're building a home for a family, which really increases the level for that next generation of the children. They now have a safe home to go to. But the other thing that comes out of it is the reward that you get back from this. I advocate that all my team members just don't bury your nose in the work. They need to take time out. The partner families that we're building the homes with are working right alongside us. So we work right alongside them. We're with their children. We're with the people of the village. Lots of the locals volunteer. And so we immerse ourselves with the people in the village and become friends with them. And so they look at us as part of their community and part of their village. They don't look at us as outsiders coming in to give them a handout. And, you know, we visit schools. My wife, when we were doing this together, she would play with the kids every single morning. And I advocate my team members take time out, play with the children, get to know the people, take a half an hour, 45 minutes out of the day. You have no idea the interaction and the communication you will have with people in the village or their children. You know, they may be inspired by something that you say or do that urges them to go on and get a better education, try to get more training, and they may just from a conversation with one of us on the team or seeing how our team works together, they may be influenced to change their lives.
Well, it's super interesting to learn about Stan, and I appreciate you telling us about your experience and your energy for this program. Stan Duda is the Habitat for Humanity Global Village Program team leader. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Catherine says, I just wanted to be sure you heard about Village to Village Project, a Vermont-born nonprofit that's been doing amazing work in remote northeastern Uganda for the last 16 years. When a young man from Uganda shared with members of the First Baptist Church of Bristol, whose congregation celebrates its 225th birthday tomorrow, about the desperate poverty of his mother's village and the high number of children there orphaned by the AIDS epidemic and civil war, they responded by sending money for food and clothing. What started as a simple relief effort gave birth to a vision for a village in Vermont to make a long-term, life-changing difference for a village region in Uganda called Serere. David Bradbury is president of the Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies. VSET members have done some pretty interesting things around the world, and so has David. Nice to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me in, Jane.
So how does VSET foster global entrepreneurialism and aid?
I use startups because I mumble that too. So, sure. One of the things we have with our partners at UVM and Norwich University and Middlebury College is just access to a lot of their global students that come and want to affect change through social enterprise, and through our teaching and through our counseling have really worked with a few a year that really are developing businesses that have a direct benefit back to sort of the source population. A couple examples might be Mountain Bike Afghanistan. Advancing peace in Afghanistan one pedal at a time is Fareed Nouri's mission, and he's doing that by bringing mountain biking back to his home country. He brought the first tennis court to a girls' school as a young teenager, and this is really his belief and passion as a professional cyclist to have races. So this year, September 27th, will be the second Hindu Kush Challenge, where they have a global audience of mountain bike racers coming there. And I think Moab is something all mountain bikers in Vermont know of. That's a place to go out west to bike. But Moab to Afghanistan means mother of all bombs. So that's something that just touched our hearts when we were working with that student. So what can we do to help them get sponsors, a business model that can help scale this nonprofit globally, which has been really neat to see.
So in some ways, the students have had these ideas and maybe even been doing work, and then the center can sort of get involved in helping bring more technology, more forces on the ground, and more sort of know-how?
Absolutely. I mean, at the heart, VSET works with people, places, and capital. And in that particular example, it's, okay, here's who you need to talk to in the State Department that might be able to help, or here are some sponsors that might have an interest in helping get this off the ground. So it really is company building to benefit a group overseas. The other one we were really proud to work with was called the Fulcrum Group out of Norwich University. And this was five students and one faculty. They were from four countries. They spoke 14 languages amongst them. And they were using social media to attract, inform, and de-radicalize burgeoning jihadists, white supremacists, sort of that too topical group. And they were doing it from little old Northfield, Vermont. So we worked with them on their business model, again, finding customers around the globe that wanted to implement these programs. So that was a fun one to work on. Unfortunately, that came to an end shortly in early 2017 when an incoming administration ceased funding for these programs. But I'm hoping that one's back. I'm still in touch with those folks weekly.
how do you think Vermont's energy and enthusiasm for doing good work and being on the ground and helping people in ways that they want help helps infuse this sort of work to do things elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's our sense of community, right? We're all going to get stuck in a snowbank at some point, and we're all going to help, right? Or if we have a neighbor, I have not met all my neighbors after 18 years in my neighborhood, but if there was a need, my wife and I and kids go over and make it happen. I love that about Vermont. I think we're used to creating opportunities with fewer resources. I think the small rural aspect of it is very attractive. I mean, even at VSET, we host 50 to 60 experts, ministers, leaders from around places like Nepal, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Morocco, Singapore, all come down to our office at Consolidated Communications and want to learn how to do it. So I think as a model, what can we export? Because it's a little bit easier for us to export know-how, connections, capital, networks than it is for me to take 1 or 2 weeks off a year to try to go volunteer, particularly raising teenagers.
How though, I mean, there are people who say, oh, great, you want to export all of this knowledge and technology and in some cases money to places that need it. What about Vermont? We have not solved all of our problems, even in just doing this show, several of the people that we're talking to today had to either go to a neighbor's or come to the studio because we don't have the technology to allow them to talk on a cell phone where they live. So, you know, and certainly there are more pressing problems as well when we think about poverty, homelessness, drug use, the crises that we're facing here in Vermont. And, you know, we're celebrating in this show people who are doing work in other places with need, but what about the work that needs to be done here?
Yeah, I mean, that's our day job for sure. I mean, this past year we worked with over 259 entrepreneurs one-on-one, creating employment, wealth, opportunities. And I suppose my philosophy is this. I believe entrepreneurship allows for social mobility, gender equity, wealth and income opportunities like nothing else can. And whether it's here in Vermont or around the globe, I think we as Vermonters and farmers and business owners can sort of contribute to this globally. And I have one example. ThinkMD was started by Dr. Barry Finette from UVM and the medical school. He did a volunteer project in Bhutan to help them set up emergency rooms. And from that, he had the idea, says, gosh, how can we use technology like mobile phones to put critical information in the hands of maybe not an educated or sophisticated healthcare worker or a parent or even an NGO in a country so that we can save 20,000 to 50,000 preventable child deaths a year, right? There's six people working real hard at that at our offices downtown Burlington. So, again, that's both Vermont opportunity and abroad. And I put those under volunteerism, social enterprise.
You yourself have done some work abroad too, and notably as a volunteer in Tunisia with the Financial Services Volunteer Corps, which I had never heard about.
Makes two of us.
What is it? What is it?
It was started in 1990 by the chairman of Goldman Sachs and the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, as Eastern Europe opened up following Soviet collapse. And it basically said, as new countries are born or liberated from some sort of autocratic rule, they need systems, capital markets, banks, credit, laws. And this was an effort through the U.S. State Department, the Department of Defense, that has morphed through the years and followed hotspot after hotspot. And I had an opportunity. I was contacted, given what we had done at VSET and my background in economic development as an entrepreneur and as an investor, to go to Tunisia to help them stand up seed capital funds related to their universities and incubators. Because as the Arab Spring began, Tunisia was the first. It was peaceful. It's the Jasmine Revolution over 28 days. And the first thing you need to do is figure out, how do we employ people, right? If the government's not going to hire them, which is sort of the default way, then global corporations come in. But also, what can you build locally, again, for those issues around upward mobility, income, gender equity. So that was a fascinating opportunity to go. It was about 8 months after the U.S. Embassy was attacked to be there. But the people were professional. I was struck with the education systems they had. They graduate 20,000 engineers a year free through their public schools. And then the population of women were so highly educated, independent. As they had this tectonic struggle, we looked around and said, there's no way this population is going to go back to the 13th century. This is, if any country in North Africa was going to sort of enter contemporary society, Tunisia was it, and I wanted to try to do a little bit to help.
Well, it's fascinating to hear about, and I appreciate you telling us about your work overseas, but also some of the work that especially students are doing through VSET. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
David Bradbury is president of the Vermont Center for Emerging Technologies. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're going outside the confines of our name, and we're talking with people who've done interesting work in other parts of the world. It's loosely tied to our old Vermonters Without Borders series. And let's go to Cindy Burns, who's calling in now. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning, Jane. How are you?
I'm great. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you've been doing?
Sure. My husband and I started an organization called She Wins 12 years ago in a small village in South Africa. And we bring American volunteers, women in their 20s, to South Africa for 3 months. And they mentor the girls, grades 1 through 7 in our school, in math and reading and science and athletics and sports. It's a really low-key, word-of-mouth organization. My husband and I run it by ourselves. And we've had 42 American girls come over so far and have had their lives transformed. I have to say that of those 42 volunteers, most of them have gone into some kind of socially beneficial work after their 3 months stay in Africa. And they have transformed the lives of thousands of girls who otherwise would be still living the way they did. Unlike the women in Tunisia that your previous speaker spoke of, these girls live the same way they lived 100 years ago. South African girls, they fetch water, they carry firewood, they carry babies on their backs. They have no life after school, and we're trying to transform that.
You know, Cindy, it's interesting you mentioned it's sort of almost this circle of giving out and getting back. You know, if you said that a lot of the girls who have gone on these trips to South Africa to do this work have then gone on to really significant work in nonprofits or volunteering or aid themselves. Do you think so? That seems like it's connected. I guess you could say it's chicken and egg, but it seems like those experiences in South Africa have then led them to more work on their own.
Unquestionably, and they'll cite that, and they'll tell you that. I decided to go into nursing because of the needs I saw. I decided to become a teacher because I really love transforming the lives of young girls. And it's epidemic. I mean, it happens over and over and over again. It's a wonderful thing to see.
Well, Cindy, thank you so much for telling us a little about She Wins. We really appreciate it.
And just to say, Jane, I'm looking for volunteers for this year, 2 or 3 of them leaving in January. So give me a call if you're interested.
Cindy, we'll get your information and we'll post it on the show page for today. So go to vpr.org and click on Vermont Edition. Give us a little time, but we'll get Cindy's information up on She Wins. That's Cindy Burns from Benson. And let's talk now to Jill Hurst. For years, she worked in Washington, D.C. as a union organizer. And now she says she figures out how to help poor people or those without a voice or have a bigger, better voice and lead a better life. She lives in Peacham and she works with the Karen Women's Organization in Burma and Thailand. Jill, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm a little worried about our phone connection, but I hope it's okay.
Yes, it sounds like you're in the middle of a hurricane or something, but I can hear you, so that's a good start.
Good.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Karen people?
Yeah, the Karen are an indigenous people who have lived for hundreds and hundreds of years on the border inside Burma and in Thailand. They're a wonderful, mostly rural people. They traditionally have been rice farmers and other sorts of, not unlike Vermont, it's a rural people. Yeah.
And why do the Karen people need aid and need this women's organization to work with them?
The women themselves formed this organization. So the Karen have been fighting for some rights within the Burmese system for a long time. They had at one point hoped to have their own country, but now they are looking for sort of like we would think of a state status so they could control the way their education is provided and certain things within their state government so they would be more culturally appropriate for the Karen traditions, et cetera. And the Burmese military, as some people may know, have been at war against a whole series of indigenous people in their country for about 50 years. And so starting in the 80s, they really aggressively bombed and burned Karen villages all along the border in Burma with Thailand, and a large group of people were forced to flee. And at that point, and they've continued to flee ever since, and so at that point, a group of women led by a school teacher who found themselves in the middle of the jungle with hundreds of other, actually thousands of other people who had been walking for weeks and months in some cases, and said to people, we need to get organized to figure out how to survive, and any women who want to help, meet me on this hill tomorrow. And about 2,000 women came, and they formed the Karen Women's Organization. And they do human rights documentation, they work against domestic violence and provide safe houses, and they try to fill the gaps where international aid doesn't. So they provide special education in the camps because there's no international special education. So they taught themselves to work with special ed kids. They do, as I mentioned, domestic abuse work. They run about 100 nursery schools back inside the conflict zone in Burma in order to provide early childhood education and allow women not to be working in the fields in a conflict zone with a child on their back. So they're just an amazing group of women, and they have really done a great job of trying to maintain their culture and fight against incredible human rights violations by the Burmese army, and supported other groups like the Rohingya, who the army has used rape as a weapon of war and committed genocide against. So they're pretty fabulous. I sort of help out around the edges.
You know, Jill, your phone line is difficult, but I just
Sorry.
Before... No, that's all right. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, you know, is there anything that you've learned through this work that has surprised you, or that you've brought back to the time, you know, about half time that you spend here in our region that maybe you wouldn't have had if you hadn't been doing this work?
I've learned a whole lot of things, but I would guess the main thing I always think is that they're much more communal culture than Western culture, and so they really work to solve problems together as opposed to assign blame, and they really work to find the best ways for all of the women to contribute to their effort to make their lives better, as opposed to sort of saying, oh, this is a talented person and that isn't. They never do it that way, and it's really been a wonderful education for me to just be much kinder.
Yeah, we could all use that.
Yeah, exactly.
Jill Hurst works with the Karen Women's Organization in Burma and Thailand. Thank you very much for talking with us, Jill.
Thank you.
Diane in the Northeast Kingdom emailed, I've spent the largest part of my life living in Mexico, working as a linguist in minority languages. And Alexandra in Winooski says, in January, I spent a week in Ecuador on a humanitarian clowning trip with Patch Adams. We clowned in hospitals, psychiatric units, addiction treatment facilities, etc. And let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Tim. What's your experience?
Hey there. Thanks for doing the show. This is a great topic, very close to my heart. Many years ago, I went over to Nepal to study language, actually, and a good friend of mine had, after the Maoist insurgency, started an NGO that at that time was focused on, you know, securing safe housing and rehabilitation resources and stuff like this. And the past couple years, we've been bringing U.S. high school students out every summer to do 2 to 3 week trips in the high Himalayas, in Cambodia, Thailand, Indonesia, marine conservation, things like that. And, yeah, I just wanted to speak especially to the sort of dual benefit of those trips. Obviously, it's wonderful to go do all this work and to help the communities out there, but to me, the big part that sticks out when seeing these students sort of before, during, and after is just the benefit of getting them out of their box, sort of digitally, you know, unhook from things, because obviously Wi-Fi is not the quickest thing out there. I think more people should do it. I think it really changes the perspectives of these students, 15, 16, 17-year-olds going to, you know, remote Himalayan monasteries and building greenhouses.
Well, Tim, it sounds amazing and a wonderful thing, as you said, to do to get young minds involved in some ways getting outside of their own experience and if nothing else, to experience other parts of the world. And then so many of us bring that back to our home communities to say, this is not the only way of doing life. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. Jonathan Hoffman is founder and director of Direct Aid International. The aim of the organization is to help out in crisis situations by providing aid directly to people who are often isolated from other forms of assistance. And Direct Aid International focuses on education and agriculture. Jonathan, it's a pleasure to have you join us.
Thanks, Jane. It's a pleasure to be on.
So where does Direct Aid International fit in when we think about all of the money that pours in often during crisis situations? And, you know, your organization takes a slightly different or, you know, different tack, different approach. So how do you fit in?
I fit in because I do it directly with the people that are going to benefit from it. So when I visit a rural village in Afghanistan, I'm sitting down with the elders and the local villagers and working on an agreement and a plan that they then take over and implement themselves. So there's no middleman. And when you start looking, and there's no salaries involved as well, except for maybe a contractor or construction worker, there's, you know, the elders aren't receiving any stipend out of it. I'm not receiving any pay. My colleagues and my travel companions aren't as well. So when you start looking at the cost of delivering aid the way we do it, a lot of it is in air conditioners and computers and plane tickets and conferences and office space and apartment space and security before you even get to delivering the aid.
So does being small allow you to be nimble in a way that something like the Red Cross just can't be because of bureaucracy?
Well, I yes and no. I mean, I think that they have a responsibility to the people that work for them that they don't allow them to go to certain locations where being the founder and the director and the only technically employee in the organization, I can make all the decisions and determine where I want to go and how. So I think that makes it very beneficial for me and for the villages I work with. But I think that the Red Cross, you know, I've seen their work in a number of different locations and don't want to dispel the thought that they're not doing good work as well.
I understand that when you started this work about 20 years ago, you worked in Kosovo for a couple of years, and you've spent the last 18 years doing this work in Afghanistan.
Exactly. Yes. So I did start in Kosovo. So this is my 20th year. And I was in Kosovo for a couple of trips. I hadn't started my organization and was working under the umbrella of a local church that had actually got me going by contacting me and asking me if they could support me for another trip after my first one. And that worked out well for a couple of years, but I really needed to go out on my own. I couldn't have a Christian-based organization or any religious-based organization overseeing the work, especially in Afghanistan. And so after my first trip to Afghanistan, I incorporated myself and I'm registered with the IRS. I'm a 501c3. I'm tax deductable. Bill Gates can give me money.
Well, we can always hope.
Nah, I'm not even trying, to be honest with you. The money comes to me. You know, people have heard about my work, and when they realize how I do it, they have actually contacted me, and I have two foundations now that support me for the last 5, 6, 7 years. And so I'm looking for another foundation or two here in the future to expand my work, but I'm really not out there beating the drum for my organization. And this is the first time I've talked to somebody in 6 or 7 years. I think you were the last one I did speak with, Jane.
So, Jonathan, one of the things that you do is you build schools and libraries in Afghanistan. And I think you've built something like 49 schools and 3 libraries. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm working on 48 and 49 members schools this year. We contracted a 3-room and a 4-room. And also we started doing libraries. I did one way back in 2004 outside of Kabul, but last year we decided to do one for a village that had schools in existence, but they wanted a library, and there was over 1,400 kids there. So we thought that was a good investment for $7,000-$8,000 to, you know, we'll go back this year or next year we'll go back and buy supplies. They're not quite finished, but we gave them money to put the shelving in and put some desks and stuff. And we'll see where they go in the year, because It's not charity, and you know, it's a one-time gift. So there's, I need to see some input by the village and by the school itself, and so it's a working relationship in that way. And so we'll come back next year, see what they need, and leave them a little gift of maybe $500, $1,000. It all depends, and we'll keep supporting that library, and then the one that we started this year, we'll go back next year and look at that one and see what they need to complete the project, to finish the structure, and then probably the third year we'll go back in and give them another grant or deposit and let them get some books and stuff like that. It's a work in progress, and every project's different, and because every village is different and they have different needs and different designs, but by and large it's very successful.
You know, what's fascinating too is since you've been doing this work for so long, in some cases you're actually going back now to make improvements to some of the old schools that you built 15, 16 years ago.
Exactly. We have actually, the last 3 years, we have taken the cost of one school and put that aside so that we can go back, because there is a need. And so we're putting windows in, and we're, you know, in the beginning we would just sit there and let them kind of hang out to dry and go, no, that's it. You know, it was a one-time gift. And, you know, and then we softened it up a little bit when we saw that there was a reason behind them not getting the school complete. And I want the schools completed. So we started giving out small monetary funding to the projects over the years. But then 3 years ago, we started making a more concerted effort to go back and make sure that they are getting what they need, and even improving upon just the basics. Maybe the floor gets cemented or we get blackboards. I really draw the line at teacher salaries, just because there might be six teachers, but they tell me there's 12. So and also they're government schools. The government takes them over, and they're supposed to be paying for them and supplying a lot of the books. So, you know, there's a couple places where we don't really jump in and help them. But when it comes to primarily what I do is build the school. I give the village the money to build a school, and that's it. And so I don't get involved in what the curriculum is, and I don't get involved with how many teachers, what they get paid, or whether it's a boy or a girl school. It's what the village needs. So in that aspect, I try and keep it pretty simple for myself and for my bookkeeping.
Jonathan Hoffman is founder and director of Direct Aid International. He's in Maine right now, but normally lives in Essex. Jonathan, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
We're hearing the stories of Vermonters who have done good work in other parts of the world today. Barbara in Huntington says, I've worked internationally since 1993, first in the countries of the former Soviet Union and in Central and Eastern Europe, and then more recently in China and Bangladesh. For 3 years, I lived in Ukraine, 2005 to 2008, after the Orange Revolution. I worked on projects to help local communities solve environmental issues, help nonprofit organizations develop stronger advocacy skills, and develop health and safety training programs for workers in Asia. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont Edition's mission is to bring context to current events and look in depth at regional issues and reflect our culture and sense of place in the Northeast. But often our sense of place is rooted in how we interact with the rest of the world and what kind of impact we can have on humanity. That drive to be of use is borderless, and so today we're exploring our culture and sense of place by talking with people who root themselves in Vermont but extend their desire to work for good to other parts of the world. Amy Karst is communications director for Malaika House, which offers a home for orphaned and abandoned children in Uganda, providing education and vocational training throughout their childhoods. Amy, nice to talk with you today.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
The origin story for this organization is pretty remarkable. Can you just give us the nutshell?
Sure. So Robert Fleming, who's from Vermont and is a tennis pro, or at least was in his past life, he was in Uganda doing some work and staying in a hotel, and he saw that there was a woman living across the street, in the street, who was very pregnant, and he wanted to make sure she was okay. So he went and talked to her one day and realized pretty quickly that she was mentally ill, didn't even know she was pregnant. So he kind of kept an eye on her, and he happened to be around when she went into labor, took her to the hospital, laid down for a nap. When he woke up, she was gone. He went and found her in a bathroom, splashing water on herself, kind of covered in blood, and there was no baby around. So he went running through the hospital, went into another room, and found the baby in the trash can. And long story short, he took the baby to the doctors. The doctors came back to him and said, you brought this woman in here. She's refusing the baby. You have to take the baby. So Robert basically drove back to his hotel with a newborn baby on his lap in his pickup truck. Robert, who was in his early 30s and had never wanted to have children, you know, living his life, traveling around the world. And so he got to the hotel and decided, okay, I'll figure out what to do, and in a few days I'll find somewhere for this baby. But the next day the authorities came with another child, and then a few days later with triplets, with malaria and malnourished. And he kind of quickly realized that he either had to abandon these children or figure something out and stay with them. So he called his mom, he emptied out his 401k and rented a house, and Malaika House was born.
So the children who live at Malaika House typically live there for their entire childhoods?
Correct, yeah.
So it's not designed to be a place where people, where they're adopted from?
Correct, and not that there's always a problem with that, but for what we're doing, it really works well. I mean, the kids, this is their family. It's a home. It's a family. Obviously different from traditional families, but no less a real family. They are each other's brothers and sisters. The aunties, who are five local women who have been there since 2005 when this began, they've been there the whole time. They're like their mothers. So they're very just, you know, it's these kids aren't afraid that their closest sibling is going to disappear the next day. Like, they have each other for life.
And there are about 50 kids who live there?
There's about 50 kids. There are about 8 older girls who have since moved out on their own. They're in their 20s, but they come back and work in the Malaika House businesses. So they're still very involved.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the businesses, because this is more than just a home. It's also a place where the kids who live here get vocational training, they get education. There's a way to make a path to a career,
right,
so that you're not just sort of dropped out at 18 with no skills and no place to go and no family.
Sure. So unemployment in Uganda is about 80%, which is obviously crazy. So these kids, even with the private educations that we get them, you know, they don't have a lot of opportunity unless they get trained in a vocation that actually has some potential in Uganda, such as tourism, hospitality, and IT, which can, of course, be done anywhere in the world from Uganda. So we've been setting up businesses over the years, a pizza restaurant, we have a safari company now, we have an IT department, and then some other things that are a little more common, like craft business and coffee business, that serve as vocational training opportunities for the kids, also employs them as they get older and they work in these businesses. But the end goal, too, is to have these businesses fully financially sustain Malaika House, hopefully within about 5 years. So we still have a long way to go, but we're earning about $20,000 each year from these businesses. The safari company definitely has the potential to generate the most.
And I understand there's still a Vermont connection. You and your kids go over to work there for some time. There are students and teachers from some local colleges who spend time there. And Robert Fleming mostly lives there but comes to Vermont to do some fundraising a couple times a year.
Correct, yes. So there's a huge Vermont presence there. Champlain College goes over every year and just really does a great, it is extremely helpful. They raise a bunch of money. They go over. The kids will work and do a lot of the aunties' work, the cooking, the cleaning, give the aunties a much-needed break every year. Students from St. Mike's, UVM, because Robert was a tennis pro and was so heavily involved with these schools with teaching tennis. Lots of teachers, especially in the Mad River Valley area, and then just lots of Vermonters in general. So I go over, I have 3 kids, and we've been going for about 7 years now, since my son was about 4. And he literally, when we go to leave, he cries and begs me to leave him there at an orphanage. you know, some of his best friends are there. They love it. And I'm really grateful that my kids have, you know, been able to have that be a part of their lives as well.
Well, thank you for telling us about it. Amy Karst is Communications Director for Malaika House, which cares for orphaned and abandoned children in Uganda and provides education and vocational training throughout their childhoods. Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jane.
One more note here from Stephen in Rutland, who says, 6 years ago, I took my father on his return trip to Vietnam, where he was exposed to Agent Orange during the war. We volunteered at the Vietnam Friendship Village in Hanoi that cares for children and veterans living with the effects of chemical exposure. We were so touched by the resiliency of this community that we've stayed in touch with the friends we made there, and I've continued to support the project as a member of the U.S. committee that provides some financial support of the village's operations. Thanks to everyone for sharing their experiences. Thinking globally, acting globally, thinking locally, acting locally, it's all connected, and we appreciate your stories.